Okay. Hopefully you are not muted, Mark, right?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Wonderful. Wonderful. We don't want you muted.
My wife would prefer if I was muted.
Oh, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. So I am going to now officially welcome you. I'm really so grateful that you're joining us. And I'm going to say that we have a link on the registration page to your website.
Oh, okay.
And to your remarkable list of achievements. I mean, I think we could probably spend the entire hour just reading your list of achievements.
No, I prefer not to do that. it just means I've been around for a long time.
Yes, I imagine you have been. So instead of reading that list, I'm just going to say that in the last decade and a half or so since I've known you, I've had many clients who beat some pretty incredible odds with your help. I'm remembering couples with vasectomy reversals.
Yes,
I'm remembering a husband who was in his 50s and a wife in her 40s with a high FSH, and they ended up having two children through successful two IVFs with your help.
Right.
And I also worked with couples who were about to start an in vitro cycle, and you advised them to wait, feeling that they have not given themselves enough of a chance to conceive naturally. So to me, those stories say a great deal about not only your incredible level of expertise, Mark, but also your integrity and your compassion. So I want to thank you in this.
Well, I thank you for recognizing the contribution of sperm to creating new life. It's not always all about the women, that men are equally important.
You know, I considered, actually, I get so many questions, you know, from people asking me, when they ask me about my program, they ask, and what about men? You know, could this work for men? And I almost titled this call, Yes, Virginia, Men Are People Too, and they contribute. I think we should dive in. And I thought, Mark, if you could get us oriented a little bit, I think it would be great to hear an accessible overview of the male reproductive system.
Yeah, before I even get into that, I'd like to provide some information that would sort of justify even discussing the male. You know, in most women, when they're not getting pregnant, the first person they go to, of course, is their gynecologist. Because unlike men, women have a long-term relationship with the gynecologist.
Mm-hmm.
Men don't have a relationship with the reproductive urologist or a urologist, and they'd be lucky to find a man who has even a relationship with an internist on a regular basis. But women typically go to a gynecologist, and logic would dictate that if they're not getting pregnant, they go to the gynecologist, and gynecologists are trained to take care of women. And the natural instinct would be, of course, to focus on the woman. And going back to biblical times, any time a marriage was barren, it was always blamed on the woman. But over the last several decades, it's become increasingly apparent that men contribute as often to fertility issues as women. And if you look at the overall statistics, it sort of breaks down like this: about a third of couples who can't conceive, it's a purely female problem, and about a third it's a purely male problem, and the other third it's a combination of the two. And the other reason to know about the man and investigate the man is it's actually much easier than evaluating the women for two reasons. The women's reproductive organs are all on the inside, and we can start with our anatomy by reminding everybody that men's reproductive organs are all on the outside. And one of the reasons for that is that the function of the man's testicles is best at a temperature about 3 to 4 degrees centigrade, cooler than the rectal temperature or the body temperature. And that's why they're hanging outside of the body. So they're very temperature sensitive. There are a lot of things about them that are temperature sensitive, but sperm production is probably the most exquisitely sensitive, not just to temperature, but to a variety of toxins, for example, Some of you may have heard about phthalates in the environment, which is ubiquitous in plastics. Just about every food that's wrapped in plastics is contaminated with phthalates. The IV tubing, even the IV tubing that's used for premature babies, shown to have significant levels of phthalates, and phthalates are weak estrogens, which can have a negative effect on the development of male fetuses. And the testicles are then connected to the penis by a series of ducts, starting with very tiny, tiny ducts. It's actually about twice the diameter of a human hair, and it's tightly coiled up like a tiny spring because it's actually 15 feet long, but it's a structure about, oh, the size of your pinky, draped behind your testicle. And the testicle is roughly the size of an egg. If you talk in terms of weight or volume, they're both about equivalent. An average testicle would be about 20 grams, which is two-thirds of an ounce. And the range is fairly wide, or 20 cc's of fluid, or mls of fluid, which is about also two-thirds of an ounce of liquid. So either by weight or by volume, that's the average size. And most of the size of a testicle, the volume of a man's testicles, and there are two of them normally, although you only need one for fertility.
It's nice that we were given spares.
We don't have spare hearts, we don't have spare brains, but God knew what was the most important thing to have a spare and gave us extra testicles. The testicles actually contain 400 U-shaped little tubules where the sperm are manufactured. And the rate of sperm manufacture is incredible compared to the rate of egg manufacture. Women are born with all the eggs they're going to ever have, and once they become post-pubertal, they typically drop one egg a month until menopause. A man, after puberty, and it can well into old age if he's otherwise healthy, manufactures sperm at the rate of 1,000 sperm every heartbeat. And anything that divides that rapidly is very sensitive to environmental toxins, to temperature, even to chronic unremitting stress. Several studies done by my late colleague Matt Hardy at Rockefeller, where my lab is, have shown that if you subject male rats to chronic stress, and the way they do that is they have an electrified cage and they never know when they get a little shock, they're completely sterile in 6 weeks. Just from chronic unremitting stress. And we know that stress has an effect on humans. Of course, experiments like this are not done on
validated.
People. We couldn't do it on people. So, and then after the sperm is manufactured at that rate, they then go through this tiny duct called the epididymis, which is 15 feet long, and it's a single tube. So if it gets infected, epididymitis, the most common infection of the male reproductive tract, and that infection is not treated promptly, or if it's a very bad infection, that could be from chlamydia, it could be from gonorrhea, it can be from a urinary tract infection, even with a common E. coli organism commonly causing urinary tract infection, it'll block that duct. Now, fortunately, there's one on the other side, so you'd have to get both of them blocked. But if the other one's not normal, say because it's not outside the body, because it was undescended, it never dropped down out of the groin, and traveled all the way down to the scrotum the way it normally does in newborn boys, those undescended testicles, even if they're brought down later, don't make sperm very well. So one of the main risk factors for men having a problem is if their testicles didn't descend and they required an operation. So let's say a man has one testicle that was undescended, but the other one's fine, and then he gets an infection, and the one that's fine, now all of a sudden he's sterile. Fortunately, we can often fix that. And then after leaving the epididymis, the sperm goes through the duct called the vas deferens. It's actually 25 centimeters long. It's about a foot long. It's about the thickness of a Venetian blind cord. It's mostly a thick muscle with a tiny, tiny opening. The inside of the vas is about three times the diameter of one of the hairs in your head. And that propels the sperm from the testicles out into the ejaculation duct, where the sperm mixes with the secretions from the prostate glands and the seminal vesicles. So most of the semen, when it comes out from a man, is not from the testicles. So just because a man has a normal amount of semen, says nothing about its fertility. After a vasectomy, which is what I do on Friday afternoons. After helping him have babies on Wednesday and Thursday, I cut them on Friday. For men who don't want any more children, those men have no change in their semen. The only way you'd know that they've had a vasectomy is looking under a microscope. You won't see sperm swimming around. So just because a man has a normal amount of fluid, that just means his seminal vesicles and prostate are normal. It tells us nothing about whether his sperm production is normal. And inside the part of the urethra, the tube that connects the bladder to the end of the penis, inside there is the sperm from the vas mixes with the fluids from the prostate and the seminal vesicles, and then it gets propelled out the penis in a process of ejaculation, which occurs at the time of orgasm. So one of the other things that's necessary to have children naturally anyway is the ability to have an erection, have an orgasm, and or at least have an ejaculation, and the sperm then gets propelled out and deposited near the female. So that's sort of the basics of the male reproductive system.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of the other reasons it's so much easier to evaluate the male is this: everything is hanging outside in the breeze. I mean, one of the unique things about the scrotum, and most doctors don't even know this, even morbidly obese men, under the skin of the scrotum, there's not one single fat cell. It's thin, stretchy skin with zero fat in it because it's designed to keep the man's testicles cooler.
That's fascinating.
So things that heat it up, like long hot baths, saunas, jacuzzi, steam rooms.
Right.
If the testicles are surrounded by a bag of varicose veins, a very common cause of infertility in men,
mm-hmm.
if the testicles keep going up and hanging out in the groin and instead of staying down in the scrotum, that can have a negative effect on them.
Mm-hmm.
And the other
That's
reason...
That's fascinating
is,
that nature has protected men's procreative prowess by,
It's quite amazing. Because there's a coating around the testicle that protects the tubes inside that make sperm. It's called the tunica albuginea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually even stronger and thicker than the coating that covers and protects men's brains, or women's brains, for that matter.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that tells us something.
Yeah. When I operate on men in that area, we have to either... Normally, when we do surgery now, we have to put our initials on the skin in the area where the surgery is.
Uh-huh.
But when it's in the scrotum, that's not the kind of skin where you generally can put your initials. So they put a bracelet on the man's hands.
Mm-hmm.
If it's right, on the right hand, if it's left hand. And on the bracelet, in addition to his name as hospital number, they have what the name of the operation is. So usually when I come in to operate on men for fertility issues, the wife is with them in the preoperative area. And I explain that I have to sign the bracelet. And I tell them that the reason is to make sure I'm doing the right operation, that I'm not doing brain surgery. You know what most of the wives tell me? They point down to his testicles and they say, that's where his brains are.
Yeah, right. So, Mark, you certainly touched on a lot of the things that you're looking for in a diagnostic workup, like infection and varicose seals.
Tumors, that's the most common cancer in men in the reproductive age group. So you want to feel for lumps and stuff, too. I pick a couple of those up every year.
So
men, you know how women should examine their breasts regularly? Men between the age of 15 and 45 should do the same thing.
Men should.
Common cancer, too. They should feel for lumps in their testicles. And if they feel one, immediately go to a doctor.
Uh-huh. I bet that isn't something that men routinely do.
Oh, I'm sure a far, far lower percentage of men do regular testicle exams than women do. They're doing all, I bet a majority of women check their breasts at least now and then, but almost
all
men do.
Well, it's not something that anybody tells them to do.
That's right, because they don't have a relationship like that like women have with a gynecologist.
Are you saying that every man should go to a urologist post-puberty?
No, I think every man should have a primary care doctor.
And
would know when to refer him for a urological problem.
If there are any symptoms.
I don't think every man. No, if you have certain urologists...
You would be way too busy.
Yes, and there aren't enough urologists around just to handle the number of patients that need to be seen as it is, but that's not the reason.
But they need to be educated about what to look for.
Yes. A good primary care doctor at least would know when to refer to the urologist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of men who I see for fertility problems, and they've had their children, they just feel more comfortable coming back to see me regularly just to get their reproductive organs and their prostate checked. But the majority of men are fine with their primary care doctor. I'm also, well, I shouldn't be surprised, but I'm still surprised at how many intelligent, well-educated men who have no financial problems and have good insurance don't even have a primary care doctor, never mm-hmm. see a doctor regularly. And these are men even in their 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's
mm-hmm.
good to have a relationship with a primary care, a preferably
yes.
good primary
oh, absolutely.
Care doctor.
I say to people often that a fertility challenge is really a way a child is sometimes trying to save your life. And, you know, there's a recent study, a Stanford study, I think, that
yeah.
came out that showed a link between azoospermia
and
cancer.
Yes, yes.
And I'm just wondering, am I remembering that you had a case you were actually testifying?
I published the first paper. This is about 2002, showing that men who have severe male factor infertility have a 10 to 20 times higher incidence of testicular cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The study that just came out from Stanford showed that if you have the worst form of infertility, a zero sperm count, and it's not from a blocked duct like a vasectomy,
right.
that you have a significantly higher risk of having other kinds, all other kinds of cancer. That it seems to be a marker for having cancer. It wasn't as dramatic an increase as the risk of testicular cancer, which I said was 10 to 20-fold, but it was a 2 to 3 times higher risk of having cancer in general. There are reasons other than just fertility for men to be evaluated if they have abnormal semen analysis or their wives aren't getting
right.
pregnant. Sometimes the reason is because they have a life-threatening condition.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it's showing up as infertility.
Right.
Other diseases, diabetes frequently presents as infertility when
right.
it occurs in younger men.
Isn't it common sense that, you know, if a symptom shows up, that it somehow is reflecting your overall level of health?
Yeah, that is common sense, but it's shocking. I think part of the problem is this is not true of the doctors, the reproductive endocrinologists that I work with for the most part at Cornell, but IVF has become such a huge competitive business, and there's so much money involved in this
mm-hmm.
that if a man has enough sperm to inject into the woman's eggs, they bypass the male altogether. And I see this time after time after time. Couples who don't come to me until they've been through 3 failed IVF cycles, and only then do we discover that the man has testicle cancer. That was fairly recent. I picked up another one of those. Or he's a diabetic, or he has some other serious medical problem. So there are reasons other than just helping a couple have children to have a man who has a fertility issue evaluated.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you're saying
health.
That. Yeah. It also seems just so unfair that ICSI is used so widely with couples where the woman is, you know, has a perfect workup, has
right,
perfect
right.
level.
It's being done for the male. They
and
do
she
it instead
is
of,
asked,
instead of treating the male. And ICSI
exactly.
is not without risks. I don't know if you're familiar. A paper at the end of 2012, just a little over a year ago, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, the most prestigious journal in the medical field, from Australia, looking at 6,900 and something births. I mean, 690,000 births, and they compared birth defects in the offspring of babies conceived with ICSI versus those that were not conceived with ICSI, and the birth defect rate was 3 times higher.
Yes,
now, still, the majority of the ICSI babies were normal, but
mm-hmm.
logic would dictate that when you bypass the natural barriers that prevent that bad sperm from getting into an egg, that it might create problems, and in fact it does. So
mm-hmm.
even
mm-hmm.
ICSI is not only not without risk to the mother, but not without risk to the offspring. And that's something that, you know, the IVF doctors tend to ignore, which is unfortunate. But on the other hand, there are, you know, millions of couples or in the babies that have been conceived that would not have ever been conceived without ICSI. But it has to be applied judiciously and appropriately, and currently it's often applied indiscriminately as in an effort to just bypass the male. Instead of having a male fixed, we'll just put you through ICSI and you'll have your baby that way, because it's become such a huge business.
Absolutely. I'm really so glad that you are pointing this out, because I see it all the time with people who come to me. And
right.
Is it also that ICSI boys, do you know what is the percentage of ICSI boys?
ICSI boys specifically have a much higher incidence of genital anomalies. Undescended testicles higher in ICSI boys. Hypospadias, where the urinary opening doesn't come out the end of the penis. It comes out like in the scrotum or the bottom of the shaft and requires an operation. That was actually a study done at Cornell by Dix Poppitz. The chief of pediatric urology had just noticed he was seeing an awful lot of hypospadias and undescended testes, more than he used to. And then he looked at the IVF database at Cornell and a collaboration with other institutions, and found it was directly related to boys ICSI. That were conceived with ICSI.
That is alarming, because we're kind of creating the new generation of infertility patients, right?
That's right, we are. You know,
so
by the same token, there are some, you know, for example, one of the causes of a zero or extremely low counts is if you're missing a piece of your Y chromosome. And now the Y chromosome is the chromosome that men have, not women. In the past, that kind of fertility problem couldn't be passed on. But now we're actually able to find rare pockets of sperm in men with this condition, inject it into the egg. But those male boys are going to have exactly the same fertility problem as their father. So we're perpetuating that type of infertility. I can't say that that's a bad thing, because these are couples that never would have had children any other way. And if that's the only problem these boys have, that they have to go through the same thing to have kids as their father did, it's not so terrible. But some of the, as you pointed out, is that what we're doing is we're creating a generation where infertility is being passed down, whereas in the past it wasn't.
I mean, if it can be avoided, certainly it would make sense.
Yeah.
So if somebody comes to you, you know, you're looking at count and motility and morphology,
right.
What would you suggest to a couple before you would refer them to ICSI?
Oh, well, first, there's so much more. Actually, what you mentioned is a good place to start, because it's so much easier for a man just to give a semen specimen in a cup to get himself checked. He doesn't even have to have anybody touch him. So any time a couple's having trouble with fertility, sure, see the gynecologist, but don't let anything invasive be done to the wife before the man has just brought in a semen specimen and had it checked. I've been shocked at how many couples have, where the wife has been through laparoscopy, all kinds of invasive testing before the man ever got checked, and he turns out to be Zippo, and she turns out to be perfectly normal and didn't need to go through any of that invasive stuff. So the simple thing, as you alluded to, is get a semen analysis. And if a semen analysis is absolutely normal, that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't a problem with the male. I always like to get at least two of them 4 weeks apart. There can be a lot of variability. And the semen analysis in and of itself is a relatively crude indicator of fertility. Sure, you have to have a reasonable number of sperm, somewhere between 20 and 200 million per ml of fluid, maybe a total of 100 to 200 million. About half of them should be swimming reasonably well. We like to see a good percentage of them have a nice normal shape. If there is some abnormality in the semen parameters, even if it's enough for IVF, even if it's enough for IUI, but it's not normal, have it repeated and have the guy at least looked at. Because looking at the guy is such a simple, non-invasive thing. Because there's no fat in the scrotum, because the testicles hang outside of the body, an experienced reproductive urologist like myself and the people I train can usually figure out what's going on first by talking to the couple. A lot of stuff in the mat. Did you have bilateral hernia repairs done with mesh? And is that why you have a zero sperm count? Because the mesh ate into your vas? You've heard probably about what the mesh has done to women with incontinence. The same mesh eats into the vas deferens and makes men sterile. Have you had a history of diabetes, an undescended testicle? Were you an alcoholic, a drug user? So first, you want to get a really good history. And often I can figure out what's going on just from the history. And then after the history, a good exam. And the exam in the man is so easy. It's not just dropping the pants, though. You want to make sure they have a normally masculinized body shape, that they don't have a breast enlargement, which you would see if they have too much estrogen or too much prolactin. And then you want to examine the testicles. If they're really small and soft and mushy, that usually tells them there's a production problem. Sometimes you could tell right away that the vas deferens is missing. And those couples, we can suck sperm out, and those couples are the ones that could never get pregnant, but now we get them all pregnant with IVFXC. That's actually, from being the worst thing to have, it's now the best thing to have a missing vas deferens. You're born with a vasectomy.
You would do aspiration?
Aspirate sperm, yes. What's interesting is these men almost all have, this is a form of, believe it or not, of cystic fibrosis. They all have a mutation of the cystic fibrosis gene. Instead of having the real bad lung disease and pancreas disease that babies and boys with full-blown cystic fibrosis have, the only manifestation of the disease is that they're missing the vas deferens. If you look at all boy babies that have cystic fibrosis, all of them are missing their vas deferens.
And, Mark, the sperm that is aspirated, is it viable sperm?
What is the percentage of viable sperm? Of all the causes of infertility, this went from having the lowest pregnancy rate to now having the highest pregnancy rate. With a good history and a careful exam, and even just looking at the semen specimen myself, by seeing if the volume is normal, I'll put a drop on a slide, and before getting a formal count, I can tell but just by looking at a drop on the slide about how many sperm there are, how many are swimming. So just with a history, a simple exam, which is not at all painful, and a drop of semen, no needle sticks, no invasive tests, no x-rays, I can 90% of the time figure out what's wrong, and then the other tests are just to confirm it. And logic would dictate, at least start with a semen specimen. If that's not normal, then send the guy to get checked. You were asking about, you know, semen analysis. There were newer tests now that even men that have a normal sperm count and the sperm seem okay, we now have tests that look at the quality of the DNA inside the sperm. And we've seen men where everything looks normal, but their wives aren't getting pregnant. It turns out they have a very high level of fragmented DNA. And those often don't even work with IVF. And often
and
there are some
that,
things we can treat.
So you would treat the fragmentation?
Well, you find out what's causing it. Excess heat, drug and alcohol abuse, varicose seals, one-sided blockages. There are many causes of this that can be treated. And then the couple can go on to conceive either naturally or with a less invasive assistance like intrauterine insemination.
So that's interesting. You know, we're talking about fragmentation of in embryos, and now we're talking about...
Yes, there could be fragmented DNA inside the sperm, and we now have some good tests for that. In fact, that's a test... Well, because I'm an academic and I'm a researcher at a university, I order those tests on almost every man I see because we're collected. By doing that, I'm learning what are the things that it's associated with and what makes it go down, how can we treat it.
And they're
just sperm tests. They're totally non-invasive. They're just sperm tests, sperm tests.
So the DNA testing is not routinely done, though?
No, it is not routinely done. It should be done much more often. It's starting to become more acceptable. It just requires a semen analysis. There's a very well-known commercial test called the sperm chromatin structure assay, which has been around for 25 years, which is a very good test, and it just requires the patient to send the specimen to the company, and they'll do the test. And then there's a newer one that we're doing at Cornell and our IVF group that uses it also. It's called a tunnel test, T-U-N-E-L. That looks at how many nicks there are in the sperm DNA. And we found that men that have a higher than 20% of their sperm have nicks in them, not one live birth, even with ICSI. So those men, we know not to put them through more ICSI, not to put them to find out what the cause of it is and treat it. And more than half the time, we can find the cause and we can treat it.
What are some of the causes of something, of a symptom like that?
Well, one of the causes, as I alluded to, is drug and alcohol abuse, very toxic for sperm. And if you can get a patient to have major lifestyle change and stop using drugs and alcohol, you'll often see that improve. The varicose veins in the scrotum, a condition called varicocele. It's the same as varicose veins. A lot of women get them in their legs after childbirth.
Right.
From the baby pressing on the big veins. If you get them in your rear end, we call them hemorrhoids.
Mm-hmm.
But when they occur in the legs or they occur in the hemorrhoidal area, they don't heat up the testicles. What they are is they're veins filled with warm blood that have thick walls. And if your testicles are surrounded by that warm blood, they get too warm. And they cause fragmented DNA. They can cause lower sperm counts. They can even cause lower testosterone levels. The male hormone is affected by that, too. If you then fix the varicocele with microsurgery, the fragmentation improves, the sperm counts go up, even testosterone levels go up.
Actually, since we are talking about varicoceles, and
yes.
since that is one of the questions actually several people sent
yes.
in, do you recommend treating varicoceles every grade, or are there some varicoceles that you
feel... I'm more enthusiastic about fixing the higher grade varicoceles. I published a study many years ago in which we looked at the outcomes of varicocele repair on semen sperm counts and quality and how it related to the size of the veins. And the bigger the varicocele, first of all, the worse off the man was to begin with. He had a
right.
lower sperm count, poor sperm quality. But the converse was also true. The bigger the veins, the bigger the improvement we saw in semen quality. So generally, when you fix higher grade, larger varicoceles, you tend to see a more substantial improvement than when you fix smaller ones. So I always tend to be more enthusiastic. Also, if the varicocele is associated with a lower testosterone level, I'll be more prone to recommend repairing it, because testosterone is a male hormone that gives men their sex drive, but also their energy level, their muscle strength, even their bone density. Younger men with lower testosterone levels, I'll repeat it, if it's low again, we'll get a bone density, and 30% of them will already have pre-existing osteopenia, just like a post-menopausal woman. And men with low testosterone are also more prone to depression,
so,
a general health issue, not just a fertility issue. So
right.
if I see a man who has a high-grade varicocele, and his wife's pregnant, and they deliver twins, and they don't want any more, but he's got a low testosterone, I'll fix it anyway, just because it's a long-term health benefit for him. It may then obviate the need him requiring hormone replacement therapy when he's older.
So you're saying, Mark, that if it's a lower grade varicocele, you would test, you would do other testing like testosterone levels to determine.
I wouldn't immediately jump to fixing it if it's a lower grade varicocele. But if it's a high grade varicocele, and especially if they're usually on the left side because of the anatomy on the left side, they're usually bigger on the left. And if on that left side the testicles also become kind of shrunken and is softer, and if on top of that, in addition to an abnormal semen analysis, they have a low normal or below normal testosterone, then I wouldn't pursue a whole lot of further testing. Then I would just recommend repairing it. The cases where I'll do further testing is where the veins don't seem that big. I'm not sure if it's going to be a benefit. Then I'll do two things. I'll get those DNA tests that look at the sperm DNA. Just a semen analysis and look at, there's a lot of fragmented DNA, and I will get an ultrasound, a painless sound wave picture. Women who've had IVF have had a million of them, and it's much
right.
easier in guys, because the ultrasound, if it's done properly, it has to be done with the man standing up and then lying down, and he has to do something called a Valsalva maneuver, which is straining as if you're trying to make your muscles real big like Arnold Schwarzenegger or something, and the good sonographers will tell me the diameter of the veins. They should be smaller than 2.5 millimeters. And when they do that straining or coughing, the blood should not turn around and go backwards, because the valves in normal veins are competent. In varicose veins, the valves inside veins are not working properly. So when you cough or strain, increasing your abdominal pressure, the blood in those veins turns around and goes backwards down to the testicle. And you can actually feel it if you're a good examiner. But on an ultrasound, it'll show that. So if it turns out that on my exam the veins aren't that big, but the man has a lot of fragmented DNA, and the ultrasound shows that he has vein size of 5 millimeters instead of 2.5, and he has backwards blood flow when he stands and when he lies down, those I would be more prone to fix.
Okay, that's wonderful. That's one of the questions. So actually, I'm going to read you one of the questions
sure.
as it
sure.
came in.
Yeah.
you know, to give people an opportunity. This is a 35-year-old young man.
Yes.
And he doesn't smoke, doesn't drink, works out 6 days a week, swims, and does elliptical and weights, and drinks caffeinated tea daily. Actually, it's something I definitely want to talk about, caffeine.
Right.
And one Diet Coke. So he has caffeinated tea and a Diet Coke.
Right.
And the majority of his diet is organic and healthy, vegetables and all that.
Right.
And he has been tested, and he was at zero on a four-point scale at Colorado Center. Morphology.
Oh, his morphology was zero. Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Zero on a four-point scale at Colorado.
Okay. Well, it's not so much a four-point scale. Zero on a scale where normal is over 4%.
Oh, I see.
That's what they're referring to.
Okay. I'm really just reading off.
Yeah,
what
sure.
They,
no,
what
and
they
I know the place in Colorado that he's talking about. Okay, that's very good.
And he is at 4% on the Kruger morphology.
Right. Okay. The Kruger morphology. Okay.
At specific.
That's also a strict morphology. Normal Kruger would be over 14. For the purposes of IVF, if the Kruger is over 4, usually you can get away without ICSI.
Okay. So
go on.
He was at 4. At Pacific Fertility Center.
Yeah.
We're not going to be mentioning any names here.
Sure.
He must not be named. One urologist told him that he doesn't test morphology because he gave the same sperm sample to 6 labs and they
right.
all gave back different results. So he doesn't trust the test.
Okay.
And in addition, he said that you know, that if a woman is fertile, then within a year, a man, even with a low morphology, will still get her pregnant. So it doesn't have an impact, according to that not-to-be-mentioned urologist, on conception, in his opinion. And so, you know, the first question of this couple, then I have more information on them, but
yeah.
The first question is, you know, thoughts on the morphology test in general, what it indicates, and is it valid?
Yeah, well, you know, there are four different parts of the semen analysis. The volume, most of which is not from the testicle, that's the total amount of fluids from the prostate and seminal vesicles. It should be 2 to 6. And that's going to be the same in every lab. Every lab has a little container with the markings and says how many cc's or how many mls of fluid it is. That's not going to vary from lab to lab. And then the next thing is the sperm count. They take a sample, assuming it's been liquefied. They've left it for at least 10 minutes so it's not clumpy and mixed it up really well. They'll put it on a standard sperm counting slide, and the technician will count how many sperms there are in a square. And that usually will vary very little from lab to lab. And then you have the swimming ability. And most labs now will put the sperm on a screen. Out of 100 sperm, they'll be able to count what percentage of them are moving, and they can actually measure the velocity. So that's also very objective. So volume, count, and motility are very objective measures and usually will not vary very much from lab to lab.
Mm-hmm.
But morphology, a technician looks at it, depending on where that technician was trained and what
mm-hmm.
standards they're using. One technician could call it normal, another could call it abnormal. Of all the parts of the analysis, the morphology is the most subjective, the least reliable, and the one that does vary most from lab to lab.
Mm-hmm.
If, however, you have multiple semen analyses done at the same lab by the same technician, they usually will be very close to each other. In our lab, there's very little variability from sample to sample if it's done in just one lab. But the couple is absolutely correct. Or that urologist is absolutely correct. If they're done in different labs, you can get widely variable results.
But
you have to know what lab it's being done at and what their standards are.
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly would not say it doesn't mean anything, and I would not agree that a man with zero morphology is as likely to get his wife pregnant within a year as a man with a normal morphology.
I have to say, that was troubling to me
to
hear that.
Yeah.
That morphology
it does not
mean
that he's sterile, and it does not mean he can't get his wife pregnant. I've seen plenty of men with zero morphology get their wives pregnant naturally. But morphology is the least reliable. And that's exactly the kind of man where, number one, he should be seen by a urologist. He should be examined. That's exactly the kind of man that I think would benefit from having one of the tests that look at the sperm DNA intake, that has been shown to correlate with poor morphology. So if he has a couple of zero morphologies, and in addition he has a very high level of fragmented DNA or a lot of nicks in the DNA tunnel positive sperm, then that really tells us there is a problem.
Okay.
That patient should be investigated further. That's exactly the kind of man that would benefit from a further evaluation with those kinds of tests.
It happens to be the same person, but I think actually several other people had the similar questions, that his motility has ranged quite a bit. The concentration ranged from 142 million per milliliter to 40.
Right. That kind of your, remember what I told you what the range of normal is, 20 to 200? Tremendous variability, even in the same man. Chronic stress during a particular period of a man's life can suppress the sperm count. In fact, I have a slide that I show when I give my lectures in which I'm emphasizing why you need to do more than one semen analysis. It was done actually at the Cornell Laboratories many years ago by John McLeod, who is the father of modern semen analysis. And we had one of the Cornell medical students, he had one, and he was a known successful sperm donor. He gave a semen analysis every 2 weeks for two straight years. And there were some occasions, just usually before his final exams, when his sperm count dropped below 10 million, and then after he found he passed his exams, his sperm count was well over 100 million. There can be quite a bit of variability. Mm-hmm. From 40 million per ml to 140 million per ml, both within the normal range, not that unusual. Maybe 40% grade 3 on one occasion and 60% grade 4 on another occasion, not that unusual. And the same variability in morphology. So, number one, never trust a single semen analysis for making an assessment of a man's fertility. Get at least two, and if they're very discrepant, get three. Have them separated. If the man had a high fever, a serious illness, his mother or died, he's going through a divorce, those contemporarily cause a very significant suppression in sperm quality.
Mm-hmm.
You want to wait and then repeat it at another time. And if they're sort of a series of borderline results or a lot of variability, those are the kinds of men where those additional tests, such as the sperm chromatin structure assay or the tunnel assay, could be very helpful.
Okay, what a fabulously thorough answer. That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure. The tea he's drinking and the one caffeinated beverage, moderation is the key. Drinking 20 cups of coffee probably is not going to have a negative effect on sperm directly. In fact, before we had pentoxyphylline, which is used to stimulate sperm with very poor or no motility before doing IVF, we used to use caffeine because it does stimulate sperm to swim faster. But you can drink gallons of caffeine and it won't get into your semen in a significant concentration and affect its motility. But if you drink that much caffeine, it's going to cause you to become all wired and stressed. And that has a bad effect on sperm. So in that respect, that's how too much caffeine would have a negative effect on fertility, by making you more stressed out and irritable. And so moderation is really the key there.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with alcohol, moderation. We advise couples not to have more than, for the man not to have more than six drinks a week and not all at once. And to completely avoid marijuana, tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient, it concentrates in the testicle. It binds to the estrogen receptor.
Mm-hmm.
I tell patients, I don't have a philosophical thing against marijuana, but I tell patients that there's a reason that they call it dope.
Right. This idea of caffeine, I know we've talked about it. We actually talked about it the last time you were here. And now there are all these studies coming out about how great caffeine is.
Yeah.
And that caffeine is actually good for the liver. And so, you kind of told us what your take on it is, and I hope that makes sense to people.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say that there are as many studies that show us that caffeine is good as there are studies that will start showing us that caffeine is bad. And I think people just really need to be their own lab and look at how they respond. And if you need a lot of caffeine, I'm not talking about just there are several people who who asked about it, if you are relying on caffeine for energy or for whatever it is, chances are, you know, you want to look at your adrenals and you are borrowing energy from a place that you don't have.
Yes.
You know, so at some point
and
you're
going to
crash.
You know, maybe you need to drink all that caffeine because you sleep poorly. And that's certainly not going to have a beneficial effect on your general health or your fertility. You
right.
drink
so
a lot of caffeine to keep yourself awake because you're not sleeping properly, and then it creates a vicious cycle because having all that caffeine then creates a situation where it's even more difficult to sleep.
Good. So another quickie, Mark. Thank you so much. This is.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I hope everybody is just cheering. I know I can hear them. Everybody's just cheering for you. Here we go, a question. My husband was diagnosed with non-obstructive azoospermia.
Non-obstructive azoospermia, okay.
And he had a TECE procedure, which was unsuccessful.
Testicular sperm extraction procedure, yes.
And zero sperm was found.
Okay.
And we're busy trying to conceive with donor sperm with three pregnancies.
Right.
Essentially, her question is non-obstructive azoospermia ever reversible?
First we azoospermia means no sperm production. I mean, no sperm in the ejaculate. And,
right.
and if you think in terms of broad causes, or zero sperm counts is what azoospermia means. It means a
right.
zero sperm count. And if you think in terms of broad categories, there are just two possible causes. It could be that you're making sperm, but they can't get out.
Mm-hmm.
Like I alluded to the men who were born without a vas deferens.
Right.
The reason their success rates are now so high is they all have normal production and we just have to get the sperm out. We can suck it out. The
mm-hmm.
other cause, if it's not a blockage, it's a production problem. So it's always either a production problem, you're not producing the sperm,
mm-hmm.
that's what non-obstructive azoospermia is, or it's an obstruction. This man has non-obstructive azoospermia. And if he had seen a urologist before doing the test, I'm sure the urologist did two tests. To see if he could find the genetic cause. He did a karyotype to see if the man had the normal 46 XY chromosome pattern or if he perhaps had the condition called Klinefelter syndrome with an extra X chromosome. That's called Klinefelter syndrome. And the other thing he should have tested for is to see if he's missing a little piece of the Y chromosome. Because if he is missing a piece of the Y chromosome, it depends on which piece of the Y chromosome he's missing that can help predict whether he's treatable or not, whether he can ever make sperm. There are three parts of the Y chromosome that we test for, A, B, and C. The most common part missing in men with zero sperm production or non-obstructive azoospermia is part C. But in those men, we can find sperm inside the testicle somewhere with the TEFI about half the time.
Mm-hmm.
If, however, he's missing A or B, we've never found sperm. We don't even bother putting those men through TEFI.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, how the TEFI was done. One urologist's TEFI could just involve a few samples of a small part of the testicle. The TEFIs that we do at Cornell, the testicle is literally split in half. The patient is put to sleep. And then with a high-power operating microscope, we search through every single one of those 400 tubules on
mm-hmm.
both sides to see if we can find sperm. And
well,
typically, in men with a diagnosis of non-obstructive azoospermia who are not missing the A or the B part of their Y chromosome, we can find little pockets in half of them. Now, it
mm-hmm.
sounds like this unfortunate couple, if they had that type of extensive search and
mm-hmm.
nothing was found, right now, we don't have any treatment for them.
Mm-hmm.
Who did the TESI? What
right.
kind of evaluation they had? Did they have a proper evaluation before the TESI? Were they, for example, there are certain reversible causes of non-obstructive azoospermia. The causes of non-obstructive azoospermia that potentially are reversible are those that are induced by taking testosterone, steroid abusers. They have non-obstructive azoospermia. And if they stay off of the steroids, the testosterone anabolic steroids, and you can then treat them with HCG or sometimes even just Clomid, that can be reversed.
It sounds like this couple would do very well finding their way to your office
My colleague who does non-obstructive azoospermia, yeah. Dr. Schlegel, Peter Schlegel, my former fellow, he's now the chairman of urology at
Wonderful.
Cornell. He specializes just in the TESI procedure.
Great.
The couple could also start, they could send me or email me or call my office. And if they send all the records, I can also, without seeing them, tell them whether it's even worth coming for a visit. If they don't
Wonderful.
Area.
Thank you so much, Mark. A quickie, antidepressants. So this gentleman is taking antidepressants. Do they have, I imagine they do have.
Yeah, there's a particular class of antidepressants which is known to sometimes have a very severe, devastating effect on sperm quality, and those are the SSRIs, like Prozac, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Those, these are studies from our institution and others have clearly shown they can have a dramatic negative effect on male fertility. So if a man has very abnormal semen analysis and he's taking the SSRIs, like Prozac, for example, then he should talk to a psychiatrist about switching him to a non-SSRI. An example of one that works well that does not hurt sperm is Wellbutrin.
Okay, wonderful. So I hope you heard that, the beautiful young mom-to-be that asked that question for her husband.
Sure.
And let's just, you know, to end on a hopeful note and on, you know, being proactive and preventative and all of that, what are some things that people can do? Intervention, supplements, I mean, I know that's my whole work is about that, but
no,
I would love to hear from you.
I have a whole sheet, and if they go to my website, which you say it's linked to, they could find out, I have an information sheet called Lifestyles. Well, I used to call it Lifestyles of the Infertile. but we gave it a more positive spin. But
Lifestyles of the Infertile.
You may have heard of the Cochrane Reviews from Britain, which only looks at really good evidence-based data, whether to recommend a drug or a treatment. And they actually found that the supplements that have been used for men can have a beneficial effect. For example, enzyme CoQ10 appears to have a beneficial effect on sperm, and I recommend that. The best source for getting all of the vitamins that you need is actually eating a very healthy diet full of fruits and vegetables.
Absolutely.
That's clearly, you know, the very best source. Avoid long hot baths, saunas, jacuzzi, steam rooms. You know, I tell patients don't wear tight plastic underwear or Mick Jagger pants. Drugs and alcohol have a very negative effect. Chronic unremitting stress, I think in New York anyway, is one of the biggest things I see. I think it's a very important factor. Overweight heats your testicles up directly from the fat around them and also dilutes the amount of testosterone that gets to your testicles. So keep your weight in a healthy range. Hopefully this is common sense.
Hopefully people do know about a lot of these things.
Buying it is different than knowing it. A lot of people know it but are unable to
follow
apply
through.
It.
Absolutely.
Maybe the motivation of wanting to have a child will help them apply it.
Absolutely. If they are to implement these lifestyle changes, considering that sperm development takes, 70?
About 3 months.
3 months.
Yes.
So would you recommend that people wait 3 months and see, you know, implement some of these changes?
Oh, sure. You know,
if
a guy is, say, drinking heavily, you know, I see an awful lot of couples, and the guy doesn't really think he has a problem. Oh, I have 20 drinks a week because that's my work. Everybody in my business, we go out and we have lots of drinks, so I have to drink, but they don't have to drink, of course. So something like that, then they make that change, and make the change, and then repeat the tests in 3 months, and usually you'll see a dramatic difference.
Mm-hmm.
Even
mm-hmm.
stress reduction. I suggested that men exercise regularly is a good stress reducer. Meditation is a good stress reducer.
But in terms of exercise,
I found acupuncture is a good stress reducer.
Right.
So anything in your life that reduces stress, moving to Woodstock is a good way to reduce stress.
Yes, moving to Woodstock is the best. But but in terms of exercise, actually, too much. I know you're a marathon runner. But too much exercise is not something you would recommend.
Yeah, too much exercise, especially in women who become obsessed and become weight too thin, they can have problems with ovulation.
Okay.
And then you have to get up to really high levels. The world-class runners that are putting in 100 miles a week running, they have lower testosterone levels and lower fertility. moderation, whether it's running, biking, fast walking, do it 3 or 4 times a week, enough to make you sweat. 3 or 4 times a week, 30 to 40 minutes a week, is enough to have the beneficial effect on your body and your mind without going overboard.
Okay. So, Mark, one more, and then we'll let you go. Lots of people were asking about this. You know, would you recommend some people say that they should abstain from sex for a certain, length of time before ovulation?
No, actually, in fact, the more recent data shows that sperm quality and DNA integrity, morphology and motility, except in men that have, almost zero sperm, but if you even just have a somewhat low sperm count, frequent ejaculation is actually better than abstaining. Don't abstain for more than 2 days. 7 days has been shown to increase DNA fragmentation. I actually tell couples if they're using an ovulation kit and they know when the wife is fertile, sperm stay alive inside the cervix for 48 hours, have sex every day, even twice a day if the man is up to it, because the sperm is all going to stay alive and be inside her. So unless the man has a severe fertility problem, in which case it's not going to make any difference anyway, frequent ejaculation results in better sperm quality and lower DNA fragmentation than longer periods of absence. Saving it up is actually not good for the sperm.
What good news!
Yes.
I think this is a wonderful news to.
That's a good way to end it. Everybody go do it.
Mark, thank you so much. Really wonderful, and we're going to make the transcript available.
Okay.
And I really appreciate you joining
us.
Thank you.
All right.
Good care.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye bye.